Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're taking a look at Ohio's biotech industry. It's a growing sector that already employs more than 60,000 people and pays them above average salaries. From cell and gene therapy for rare diseases to pharmaceutical packaging facilities, Ohio has become a real player in this growing market. And that was the subject of a recent article by Columbus Dispatch reporter Samantha Hendrickson, who covers medical business and healthcare. Welcome back to All Sides, Samantha.
Thanks for having me again, Amy. Happy to be here.
So biotech is a pretty wide field. There's lots of things in biotech, from healthcare to agriculture. So what branches of that field specifically were you finding, have been finding homes in Columbus?
So you're right. It is a wide-reaching umbrella of an industry. But really, when you're looking at the definition of biotech, it is the use of biological processes to develop technologies and medicines in certain areas. And here in Columbus, like you said in your intro, gene and cell therapy has really been at the heart of the biotech boom in Central Ohio. But we also have things like medical technology that's, you know, helped being innovated over at OSU, or pharmaceutical packaging to be able to deliver those medicines and those therapies that other companies around here are creating and investing in. So wide swath, but we're mostly on the medicine and therapy and how we get that medicine to the people kind of part of it here in Central Ohio.
Your piece profiled a few companies that are up and coming here in Columbus. Have a lot of companies been moving into or growing in Central Ohio in recent years?
Oh, yeah, there's certainly been growth. So if you talk to leaders of the industry, biotech has had a presence here for well over a decade. Part of that is thanks to the fact that we have some really solid academic institutions that are dedicated to research and development, like Ohio State University, but even just Nationwide Children's Hospital. Both are internationally renowned in this area. And so they've, when you look at the cities around the United States that have that strong biotech hub and foundation, they have, first part of that foundation, these academic research institutions, right?
Yeah.
But industry leaders I talked to have said there's been significant growth in about the last 5 years, and that's primarily due to gene and cell therapy, which most would credit to Andelin Biosciences, which used to be housed within Nationwide Children's Hospital. It was their gene and cell therapy development, but then it broke off into its own entity. So it's now helps get those, besides just staying in the research and development part of it, it's also getting those therapies out of the clinical trials into the real world and treating people. And then we also have places like Forge Biologics, which is also gene and cell therapy, which came in after Andelin Biosciences. You know, we've got Amgen, which recently just made an almost $1 billion investment into an existing facility up in New Albany. That's a pharmaceutical packaging company. It's going to create hundreds of jobs. And speaking to their leadership, they're really excited about growing here in Central Ohio. And then we also have one of my favorite tours that I've taken of a biotech company is Pharmavite. So those nature-made gummies that you see on your shelves at CVS or Walgreens or the grocery store, those are being developed right here in Ohio in the New Albany area.
Did you see the gummies being made? Are they made here?
They are made here, yeah. And they showed us kind of, you know, some of the science behind it and then how they make the shapes and what shapes they decide to. And that was kind of fun.
So you just mentioned four different companies. You listed them off of what they do and that they're here. And I mean, Amgen making a $900 million investment. That's almost $1 billion. That's huge. But you kind of allude to this in your article that you hear a lot about the Intels and the Andurils, you know, the drone making company. Like, you hear a lot about those companies and Amazon and Google and Meta opening data centers. But we don't hear about the biotech industry. But this is a lot of money. How are they going under the radar?
Yeah, so I talked to Eddie Pauline, who is the president and CEO of Ohio Life Sciences, which is an association made up of biotech companies and affiliates across the state of Ohio. And this is definitely something that biotech laments, right? Like, they're here, they're present. But it's a really complicated industry. You know, like we said in the beginning, it covers a wide area. They also have pretty strict regulations, given that a lot of this development is either to get medicine to people or just the medicine itself. It's, you know, it's not kind of the sexier names that we know or that we see, you know, or in, everyone knows what Microsoft is. At this point, everybody knows what Intel is. And then, you know, people might pay a little bit more attention to drone making, especially just given, you know, the global states right now. But here, you know, that's something that they're really trying to change the narrative around and push more for, because, you know, as Eddie Pauline said, those are promises in the future. We're making jobs right now. But, you know, there is a different story that they're going to have to try to tell, because it is a little bit less known. And it is a complex and fast-paced industry that people just don't really think of, I think, when they think about development in tech immediately. Mm.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Ohio's biotech industry with Columbus Dispatch reporter Samantha Hendrickson. There is mention of the state and Jobs Ohio working to bring companies here. They're always offering incentive packages to get these big companies here. Do you know if some of these biotech companies get incentives to grow in Ohio?
So there are tax credits through Jobs Ohio that help with hiring costs. And there are some grants that are available specifically to this industry. But that's something that industry leaders have said needs a little bit more work, is that investment in biotech, considering how strong it is. You know, something that several people said when I was speaking to them for this article is that Columbus is punching above its weight class in this area. It is competing with cities of a similar size that have had infrastructure for much longer. But, you know, they're beating it out and they're making these deals. But there could always be more. There could always be more to make sure that this stays stable. Now, these companies have said they're not going anywhere, the ones I spoke to. But there's two things that they really want to make make biotech strong here. And one of them is state support. So, for example, North Carolina is a big competitor with Columbus, and they have state grants that are specifically set aside for the biotech industry. They were the first state to have that kind of initiative, where they had consistent pouring in of money into making sure that biotech stays stable, because it's such a big deal for that area. And that's something that leaders would like to see from the state of Ohio in biotech, considering how many jobs. I mean, they employ 63,000 Ohioans, and right now, you know, industry leaders say that's only growing. And then the other part of it is, you know, a big part of the reason that people are coming to Central Ohio for biotech is that there's a really great talent pipeline, is what they said. We have Ohio State University, and then we also have Columbus State, which has been working really closely with Ohio Life Sciences and the biotech industry to have a dedicated training at Columbus State to try to get more people into the workforce. But other areas that Columbus is competing with have dedicated training centers that are routinely invested in. So that when people show up, when companies show up here in Central Ohio, there's a little less work on the front end, and they can focus on making sure that their company stays as stable as possible. So yes, there are incentives. Jobs Ohio is working hard to try to bring people here. But leaders have said, you know, this is an industry we need to be paying more attention to. We need some more support for, because, you know, we might lose out to other cities. And that's something that these companies that they've lost out have said, is that, you know, we'd love to see more training, and we'd love to see more investment to make sure that these things stay stable past, you know, initial launch and maybe past the 5-year mark. So there's some things to work on, but I think they're working hard to try to make sure that we get to that place.
Yeah, you mentioned North Carolina being our biggest competitor. You wrote in your piece that North Carolina has a dedicated training site to biotech talent. So I guess they're doing more than just having certain majors at Ohio State or focusing in on Columbus State Community College. What does a training center mean for the biotech industry? Is it like a special degree?
So that's a great question. I think it kind of depends on whether you're doing things like manufacturing or whether you're doing things, you know, again, that wide swath of biotech. I think the training center also can look like it's adjusted to the needs of whatever is there in the area. That's definitely something to look more into, and that I've talked a little bit more about with Columbus State and OSU. But I think it really can be made to fit the needs of the area and what's booming the most.
Yeah. And I mean, we mentioned at the beginning that the biotech industry is a wide swath of things, from healthcare to agriculture. Mm-hmm. So we specifically talked about one company that's a supplement maker making gummy vitamins here. I think people can wrap their heads around that. But then the big investment from Amgen is for pharmaceutical packaging facility. So what mm-hmm. does that mean? Does that mean putting pills in bottles? I don't know what that means.
No, that's a great question. I think it's however you can get the medicine from point A to point B, right? Like, we're making sure that things are safe. We're making sure that we can get the medicine and the pharmaceuticals to get to where they need to go. And so, you know, that might look like that. It might look like making just different containers and ways to put medicines into things and therapies into things. It's getting that point from A to B that you might see in your doctor's offices or at a pharmacy or in more things like clinical trials and stuff like that.
Well, and then earlier we talked about a strong focus on gene therapy, which is happening a lot here in Central Ohio. Is that more in the research aspect, not kind of like a brute force, we're making vitamins?
Oh, so sorry, Amy, you broke up for a second. Can you repeat that?
Yeah, no, I was just saying there's a strong focus on gene therapy here. You mentioned that earlier, that company that broke off from Nationwide Children's Hospital and became its own thing. But is that more of a research-based type company rather than a company that's like, you know, manufacturing vitamins?
So this is another part of biotech that gets really complicated too, right? And I think that that's a reason, you know, that people were kind of lamenting, again, like not as much attention on these, is because there are so many different steps depending on what part of biotech that you're in. So like, for example, Andelin Biosciences does that research and development, and they're going from the first step in the process all the way to the end step of the process when you're talking about delivering things like gene therapy from research and development all the way to commercialization. But then you have places like Forge Biologics who, you know, only do a couple of steps in that. So maybe they're working on getting it from the clinical stage out into commercialization only. Maybe they're not necessarily doing the research and development. So where that is definitely depends on what exactly you're doing and what part of the process that you're invested in.
Now, are there any downsides to growth of biotech companies here in Columbus? Because we constantly talk about how we have too many data centers and they're growing too fast and they're taking all of our energy. Is there any is there any downside to biotech?
You know, great question. I think that all of the industry leaders that I have spoken to would say no.
Of course,
because they want it to be here. And I think, you know, as far as the downsides of building, you know, a big building that takes up a lot of space and that takes up energy, it's going to be roughly around the same as you might see in anything else. There haven't necessarily been, I think, the same concerns around things like data centers taking up energy or taking up water. That's not things that I've seen as a concern in biotech. But I think, as with anything, when you have something like this that's promising hundreds of jobs, we want to make sure we have those, right? Anytime that I'm talking to these people when they open or they announce something, I'm always asking, like, okay, so how many jobs have you filled? Or how many jobs are you planning to? Or what's your plan for this? Because, you know, we've seen Intel pushed back to 2030. Microsoft has pulled out, you know, and that was going to create some job growth here. And so that's always the question that I'm pressing is, like, are you keeping your commitment to these jobs for the region. So I think if they do that, then I think the concerns will be less.
We've been talking with Columbus Dispatch reporter Samantha Hendrickson. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Amy. Happy to be here.
And coming up, we're going to talk about a big investment into STEM initiatives. Battelle is working with the YMCA of Columbus. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Wes Hall directs Battelle's efforts to expand STEM learning opportunities for all students through philanthropy and education initiatives. He's Battelle's Senior Vice President of Philanthropy and Education. Welcome to Tech Tuesday, Wes.
Thanks, Amy. Great to be here.
And also joining us is Samantha Stewart, the Vice President of Community Impact for the YMCA Columbus. Welcome to All Sides, Samantha.
Thank you.
So, Wes, Battelle recently announced that it is providing more than $1 million in funding to youth STEM programs. What made Battelle want to pursue this?
You know, giving in philanthropy, supporting our community is a core pillar of our mission at Battelle. We're a very charitable organization. We are a nonprofit, and we fully believe in supporting the next generation of STEM talent in Columbus. And so we give our money to help build the next generation of scientists and engineers, and the YMCA is very well positioned to help us reach students and families where they naturally come to have fun.
Is all the money from Battelle, or do you have partners you're working with this specific program?
The money is all from Battelle's corporate philanthropy. When Battelle makes profit, we give a portion of that back to our community every single year.
Okay. So, Samantha, with the YMCA, what is your role in this? You know, $1 million is a lot of money. So what are you going to be doing with it?
We actually have the opportunity to do so much really good work within our youth development programs at the Y. And we're building this on a scaffolding approach where our intent is to work throughout the multiple layers of work that the YMCA does in youth development. Last year alone, we served 45,000 youth. And it's really important for us to take this investment from Battelle and this great partnership that we have and layer it into the work that's happening at our 13 community centers, within our early learning programs, within our programming that serves teens. We just kind of look at the whole scope of work that the YMCA does, and how do we build in this really impactful gift from Battelle into making this a great opportunity for youth.
And when you say youth, what ages are we talking about?
We are working with all the way from preschoolers through school age. We have programs that go home-based programming for preschool to get them ready for kindergarten, all the way up to our high school youth.
Yeah, and Wes, the idea of teaching STEM curriculum to preschoolers sounds a little challenging, but also fun. Does Battelle hope to curate the next scientists, starting with the 3 and 4 year olds?
Well, we at least hope to provide sparks so that they can explore future careers, know they too fit into that movement and can be successful in STEM careers. We want to impact at least 1 million kids every single year through our philanthropic outreach. And when we think about the STEM work, it's not necessarily that every student's going to become a scientist or an engineer. It's about building critical thinking skills, collaboration, being able to communicate your ideas to your peers. And so those skill sets are useful to every career and any career that you might go to in life.
And Samantha, are you? Is this new money for the YMCA, or is this? Did the program already exist and you're building on it?
This is actually our second round of partnership with Battelle. Okay. So we've been fortunate enough now to we started this work together in 2022, and Battelle has been a really generous partner to help us kind of keep the momentum going and keep making impact.
Okay, so tell me some of the things that are being done, being learned, being, I'm assuming, being built.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we look at this as really like a culturally responsive pedagogy, right? We want to make sure that kids have the opportunity to learn STEM in culturally meaningful ways. So we're working with kids to help them learn new skills, like flying a drone, how to code, and those things are built into their everyday life. We have a wonderful STEM lab at our Eldon and Elsie Ward YMCA where kids can come in. They can learn things from, like I said, coding to they even get to work on our 3D printers. We do some really wonderful work when it comes to serving our teens to help them be immersive, interactive, and to learn as they're doing. So it's not just hands-off, it's hands-on. They're very involved in developing and working through things that they can learn and things that they can do themselves.
So this money from Battelle helped you buy 3D printers for some of your YMCAs?
Absolutely.
Yes. That's a great investment.
Yes.
What a cool thing to get to try, because I don't know about you, but I don't have a 3D printer at home. Wes, tell me about what you're hoping from Battelle's perspective, what you're hoping the YMCA is doing with the money. Buying 3D printers is a good example. What else?
Yeah, now you know where to find a 3D printer when you need it. But the YMCA is impacting kids all across the age spectrum, and I hope that we're doing that in the places where the students are naturally coming, whether that be to the fitness centers, there's access now to a STEM lab at the Eldon and the Ward YMCA, or it may be the day camps in the summer. There's opportunities where they're naturally going for fun. And I hope that they're sharpening their STEM skills, their math skills, their collaboration skills. That really provides that bridge during the summer so when they go back to school, they're warmed up. They're ready to take on the next challenge throughout the school year. And even better, if those conversations make it to the dinner table at night for the family to discuss.
Oh, you're making kids learn math in the summer? What are you doing? maybe it's a little more nuanced, a little more fun than that.
A little more fun.
Yeah. Can you give me a math example? I like the 3D printer example. What's a math program?
So I'm going to back that up a little bit and talk about binary code. So that's an opportunity to do something really creative. So we made friendship bracelets, and we use binary code as the indicators on the bracelet, and the kids developed those. So that's a really neat way to kind of look at that from a different perspective, right? That goes back to that infusing the work in ways that the kids really understand and they get.
Now, Wes, but Battelle chose to partner with the YMCA for these programs. There's lots of organizations all throughout Columbus. Tell me why the YMCA.
Well, there's a lot of great organizations in Columbus that we do support, and we do this in partnership. The YMCA was selected for this opportunity because they had access to the students in a year-round format. We're playing to the strengths of the YMCA in this opportunity and partnership. We've also supported the library to help kids get on grade level in reading through reading assistance, supporting COSI through the annual science fair science festival in May. All these partners work together. So it's not an isolated gift. It's what the YMCA moves you forward from. The next organization picks up and takes it even further throughout the year.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Battelle's collaboration with the YMCA Columbus for additional STEM initiatives. With us, we have Battelle's Senior Vice President of Philanthropy and Education, Wes Hall, and Samantha Stewart, the Vice President of Community Impact for YMCA Columbus. So, Samantha, your title is Community Impact, so I guess my next question is about the community impact of this. Having the kids learn, what does that do for the communities that the YMCA serves?
You know, and sometimes it's not just about the kids learning. As Wes kind of said, they take this home to their families too, and they share the information at the dinner table or as they're talking about homework. And the really cool thing is that we have this opportunity to make the impact, but do so in ways that's not your very traditional, again, as I said, talking to them, but immersing them in the work. Mm-hmm. And having the ability to do that and work with students and also learn from them and what their interests are is something that makes that impact even larger for us.
Were you surprised when Battelle approached you? Did you think like, well, we run our day camps, you know, and we have these games we play and we have this set schedule. Like, how am I going to add this in?
Surprised, yes, in a good way, yeah. Right? But not at all concerned about how we were going to incorporate it, because we knew that we had the foundation and the ability to take different pieces and really build them into all the different programming that we do at the YMCA, whether it's day camp or aftercare or our early learning work. We knew that we had the momentum, we had the drive of the vehicle, if you will, to be able to do that. Mm.
And the surprise factor, though, I mean, when you thought about some like getting $1 million, you know, yep. That's exciting.
That's really exciting. And yeah. And at the time, it was like, wow. Right. Yep. It's not just, it's $1 million. It was, wow, it's $1 million.
So you have to take that money. I mean, the money is one thing, but then you have to implement it. Did you have to hire more staff?
We did. We did. We hired staff. We hired STEM coordinators. Our youth development directors also were really a critical part of this, because they're working at our 13 community centers, and the work they do with youth helped us launch the work within our community centers as well. But our STEM coordinators and our director, Tanya, who oversees this program, they were staff members that were just key, right, to making this happen.
And this investment, how many years will it take you to be able to continue to do this?
Well, we started in July of 2022, mm-hmm. and I believe that we're able to continue this work through 2026 from this latest investment. Mm-hmm.
And tell me more about the coding idea, because I know for a fact I have children in my life, and getting into coding camp, there it was competitive. There's not very many spots around for the good coding camp. So tell me about getting to learn about coding.
I'm going to give you an example of an activity that we did at our Ward YMCA with Meta. They came in, we did a workshop on teaching the kids to code, but it wasn't just, here's how you code to make this pop up on the computer, or how to run a program. It was coding that helped them do beats. So the kids would then, they learned to code, and then they did beats, and then those beats turned into songs for the kids. And it was based upon what their interests were, and then they presented their beats, if you will, to a panel of judges who were able to say, here's how you did, and this sounded really great.
What other equipment? We mentioned 3D printers. Now I'm sure you had to buy some computers for that. What other equipment have you been buying?
Drones. So kids have gotten the opportunity to fly drones, and that's.
I have someone
really cool.
in my life who could use a few drone lessons. Yeah, they're not easy to fly.
Yeah. No, they're not. Also, robots. So Ozobots is something that we've used as well.
Tell me what an Ozobot is.
It's a little tiny robot, if you will, and then you use coding to actually program the little robot to follow a path and do different things, and it's based on color and lines.
Oh, I've seen those. They're super cute. They are. Wes, to bring you back into the conversation, why do you feel that STEM is important for kids to learn? Because, I mean, everyone could just wait till high school or college to figure this all out.
Sure. But also research shows that kids are making career decisions as early as middle school. So we want to catch them early. You know, we have a lot of conversation in Central Ohio about the exponential growth that we're having, the STEM industries that are coming. We want to make sure we have a qualified workforce for the future, for our city and for our state. And these STEM skills go beyond just those critical content areas of science, technology, engineering, and math. These are life skills that will be successful in any career in the future. And so we want to get the kids interested early and give them opportunities to fulfill and explore their passions.
Do you have anyone who works at Battelle who will go to the YMCA to like a meet your scientist kind of day?
I love that idea. Battelle has over 1,200 scientists and engineers on hand. A very generous organization that also likes to be engaged in the community in different ways. There's always the opportunity to meet scientists at Battelle. We'll work through how we arrange with the right time in the summer, et cetera. But they're great role models to be able to explain what they've gone through in their professional careers to get where they are today.
Well, the ones that don't work on top secret projects and
That's
can
exactly.
actually talk about it. Is that who you'd bring in?
That's who we'd bring in.
Well, I feel like the kids would get it out of them of what they actually do, right? Do you think kids can be a little tricky like
yeah.
that?
It's those 3 and 4 year olds are very curious.
So, yeah, tell me about because whenever I read about this at first, they were saying that, like, you're going to expand in the preschool area, too. So tell me about the 3 and 4 year olds. What are they learning?
And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of times people don't think about infusing STEM into the work or the learning that children that young are doing. But it's something that can be as simple as having a curriculum or a lesson built into that curriculum that talks about nature and life cycle of water or aquaponics. We developed with one of our schools an aquaponics tank. And so the kids
have, what's aquaponics?
It's a great, right? It's this great tank of water.
It's a great word.
Fish in it. And then you can grow plants from it as well. So it was a very small scale, but we were able to grow strawberries and lettuce, and the fish were in the tank helping to fertilize that, if you will. So those are the kinds of things that are experiential learning opportunities, not necessarily learning opportunities like pen to paper and reading a book, but those are the types of things that really are impactful for very young children too.
Are you planning for next year's summer camps too? I mean, I guess you have the day camps and the after school programs that you're doing right now, but do you have bigger plans for next summer now that you have more stuff and more money and more everything?
Absolutely. And one of the really great things that we just recently wrapped up was our Spirit Day, and Battelle is the key sponsor for our Spirit Day. And that's when we bring all of our day camp campers to one location, and this year is at our Whitehall Community Center. And it's a day full of activities that are based upon their whole summer experience. And those are the things that we kind of pull in as we look at building out for next year as well. And then how do we make sure that we're meeting the needs of not only the campers themselves, but also our camp counselors who are doing this really integral work, right? It's not an easy job to be a camp counselor at all. But how do we support them, not only by giving them the tools that they need, but also to be someone there showing them how to do these different activities with youth and letting them carry them out? So we're constantly iterating and planning for the next year.
And Wes, you mentioned that Battelle's philanthropy goes far and wide, and you have more investments. What other one would you like to highlight besides this one with the YMCA?
Yeah, I would love to highlight an opportunity that's open right now, especially for educators, the teachers in classrooms. We have a grant program that's open until next week, September 2nd. Mm. The Ohio STEM Learning Network is hosting a classroom grant competition. Teachers can send their ideas into us and may be awarded up to $5,000 to put those ideas into action. That really would help us expand STEM across Ohio. So any Ohio public school it's open to, and we would love to get more response to that.
So it's basically if a teacher has an idea of something they want to do in their classroom, but they need the money for it. Is that what you mean?
That's exactly right. As long as it is a STEM idea, you can go to OSLN.org, Ohio STEM Learning Network, and submit an application, and we'll get back to you.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for telling me about this project, these projects, and this money. Thank you for joining us to talk about bringing STEM to more kids. We've been talking with Battelle, Senior Vice President of Philanthropy and Education, Wes Hall. Thanks for being here, Wes.
Of course.
And Samantha Stewart, Vice President of Community Impact for the YMCA of Columbus. Thanks, Samantha.
Thank you so much.
And coming up on Tech Tuesday, will there ever be a ban of TikTok? Well, it's looking increasingly unlikely because the White House now has an official TikTok account. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Over the last year, the idea of a U.S. TikTok ban has been falling in and out of the news cycle. However, it seems the likelihood of a ban is rapidly decreasing because the White House now has an official TikTok account. Joining us with an update on TikTok is Russell Holly, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So this question of a potential TikTok ban in the United States has been floating around for over a year. But in a surprising move, the White House recently launched an official TikTok account. So if the White House now has TikTok, does that mean TikTok's here to stay?
That is the question that I don't suspect we're ever going to get a clear answer to until there is some sort of announced deal between TikTok and this administration. You know, I think that the can has been kicked down the road on three separate occasions this year, as far as when a decision is going to be made regarding whether or not the ban on the platform is going to be permanent. You know, as far as U.S. law is concerned, it is you know, TikTok should not be operating. It is simply not being enforced right now. So for long as it continues to not be enforced, the platform, you know, will continue to stay. The biggest, you know, question that comes from, you know, what will remain of this platform as it moves forward is, you know, long term, who is going to be its owner, which mm-hmm. frequently returns to conversations about whether the U.S. is going to take some sort of stake in the company, similar to how it did with Intel this week. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the idea of the White House launching a TikTok account makes it seem like they're kind of leaning into it. But I can remember doing multiple shows about TikTok going away any second. Like back in January, it was like everyone was fleeing the app and finding other ones. So how did we get here to this point where no one's talking about it anymore? I had forgotten.
Yes, I mean, the original calls to ban TikTok came at, you know, towards the end of the first Trump administration, where the audience on that platform was viewed as not particularly supportive of the administration. And there were some very public news stories about efforts that, you know, folks that had organized through TikTok had taken to embarrass the administration through one mean or another. Mm-hmm. And so that conversation continued through, you know, 4 years. There was quite a bit of discussion during the Biden administration of, you know, what this platform was capable of and who owned it, and the fact that nobody really has any visibility into how its algorithms work and how it's better at any of the other platforms at kind of guessing what it is that that you want to watch and creating that sort of adrenaline loop. Over the last couple of years, however, it's been clear that there are quite a few folks on TikTok who are supportive of the current administration. And so that this account has been created in order to reach that audience. And I think as long as there is a substantial number of people on the platform who are in favor of the current president, that it's likely that the platform is going to stick around.
Yeah, I was wondering did you dive into what the White House has posted on their brand new TikTok account?
A lot of what you see on this account is very similar to what you would see if you take a look at the White House Twitter page or Facebook profile. It's, you know, this being a video only format means that it's less, you know, kind of text or individual image, but a lot of, you know, talking about the perceived accomplishments of the administration and you know, what current stated goals are leading towards. There are a couple of videos of on the ground footage inside of Washington, D.C., a lot of things like that are, you know, very supportive of current messaging from the administration, which is what you would expect from a political social profile.
Yeah. So no one at the White House doing special TikTok dances or anything like that.
We haven't seen any dances and no live broadcasts that I have viewed. It is very much used, you know, quite similarly to how the White House Instagram profile is currently being used.
Very curated. Yeah. The tagline for the new account is "Welcome to the Golden Age of America." Do you feel, is that the right vibe for TikTok? Are they going to get a lot of followers?
The initial response hasn't been the most positive. You can take a look at a lot of the comments to the videos that have been posted, and there's quite a few references to current events that are not favorable to the administration. You know, things like that are common with just about any politician that you know goes on TikTok. TikTok has with some very few exceptions, not been you know, the most welcoming home to any kind of political message that is as curated as this, and less about, you know, kind of communicating with the audience and you know, kind of engaging with the audience directly. So I would say that the response has not been particularly positive, but I suspect that was probably anticipated and a way to garner attention.
This is All Sides and Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about recent tech news with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. So after months of potential leaks floating around the internet, Google finally held their Made by Google 2025 event, which paved the way for the announcement of several new and updated devices for their roster. It was no surprise this announcement included new phones. Doesn't every announcement always have to have a phone? So what is special about this new announced phone?
That's right. So this is the time of the year that Google typically, you know, kind of announces a massive tranche of devices that are all expected to be released before the holiday season. Apple will likely do the same in the coming weeks. This is kind of that time of year for some of these major companies. This year, the phone being released is the Pixel 10, and it comes in three different varieties. There is the Pixel 10, the Pixel 10 Pro, and the Pixel 10 Pro XL, because names must always get longer the more things that you add to them. So, you know, the Pixel 10 is and a fairly impressively priced $800 phone that has a brand new camera in it that is capable of zoom up to, you know, five times, you know, before it goes into, you know, kind of digital tech to extend the image. The battery life, Google is promising that it's quite impressive. It comes in four different colors this year, which I am a big fan of. And, you know, really, this is Google's attempt to make sure that every part of the phone is connected to its Gemini AI platform. Mm-hmm. So the goal here is less about, you know, whether or not you can ask Gemini to do things, and more about how many different ways Google can show you by showing you instead of by telling you that Gemini can improve what you're doing on a day-to-day basis.
If you care about the fact that there's four colors, you must be the type of person who doesn't put a case on your phone. You like to look at the color.
I do. I actually do put a case on my phone. I think we had this very weird period of time around 10 years ago where every phone that came out was just black. And I think that I was lamenting a time in which, you know, phones came in cool colors just because people like to express themselves. And I think that, you know, clear cases exist. So folks who like bright colors can still, you know, find ways to express themselves that way. But yeah, I think just a little bit of variety is good for all of us.
All right. So you the Pixel 10, $800 seems relatively affordable, isn't it? Right. I mean,
that, it very much is. Yeah. As kind of the first line here, you know, as far as what this is capable of. And then, you know, the Pro and Pro XL, you know, they offer, you know, a more substantial camera package. So if you are, you know, the photographer in your group, then those are likely the phones that you're looking at. And then the XL part of the Pro XL increases the physical size of the phone if you are one of those folks who prefer the biggest possible screen and the largest possible battery that you can get on your phone, then the XL would likely be the one for you.
And then they also announced a new foldable phone. Now, I still need to be convinced that I want my phone to fold. is this one still just really cool? Is it practical yet? Will I break it? Tell me about this new foldable phone.
This is actually, you know, one of the first phones where practicality is something that is actually a serious conversation, because this is the very first. And think about how long that I have been talking about folding phones just on this show. This is the first folding phone to have been released in the United States that has a dustproof rating, which means you can actually take it to a beach or, you know, have it in a work environment and not have any risk of dust getting inside of your phone and causing damage underneath of the screen.
I didn't know I needed to worry about that.
Yes, that has been a very real problem for folding phones for quite some time now. Is that there's always a chance that dust can get under the screen and cause other problems. But this is
because of the extra. Is that because of the extra seam in it when you fold it?
That's exactly right.
Okay, I get it.
Yeah, being able to handle, you know, the display flexing in one way or another meant that there needed to be a gap somewhere. And this is something that, you know, every phone manufacturer has been trying to solve for quite some time. Google appears to have gotten there first. You know, we're still running it through its tests to make sure that it actually, you know, does the things that Google claims here. But this is a phone that opens like a book, instead of opening from top to bottom like traditional flip phones of the 90s and early 2000s. This has, you know, a great big screen on the outside, so you can use it in the way that you would use a traditional phone in most cases. And they've actually made the phone quite thin, so it doesn't feel like you're holding a giant chunky phone when you go to use the phone just with that one screen on the front. And then if you decide that you need a bigger display for something, you can open it up into that book mode. And you have a screen that is frankly not all that different from an iPad mini as far as how big the display is for you know, either productivity or entertainment or things like that.
All right. And then the final thing that, well, no, there were lots of things Google announced. The final thing we're going to talk about is they have a new watch with new fitness features, including workout guidance. So my watch already yells at me if I'm not meeting my goals. So is this one going to yell at me more?
This is less about yelling at you about not reaching your goals and more about offering advice when you're in the middle of a workout. So if you have set, that you're just going on a walk and your walking cadence slows, the watch may tell you, hey, you know, from this segment to this segment, you were actually 30 seconds slower than you were before. That can help you adjust your pace if you're, you know, trying to reach a specific goal. There are going to be, you know, several examples like that throughout a workout where, you know, it will take a look at what you have done so far and offer suggestions for ways to, you know, improve that workout.
And is this watch fancier? Is it expensive than other
watches?
It is certainly
fancier looking. There's some new technology that Google is using here to fuse the glass and the display together. That makes this very round, traditional looking watch, you know, look and feel very much like a watch that you would find in a jewelry store, you know, in the way that you kind of look down at it and see this display that in many cases doesn't actually look like you're looking at a screen because of the tech that has gone into it. This is a fairly thin watch compared to a lot of the other smartwatches that are out there. And you know, Google has not had the greatest success with smartwatches in the past. Mm-hmm. This is one of the first designs that is fully, you know, baked in from the acquisition of the company Fitbit. So mm-hmm. Fitbit's engineers have been working very closely with Google over the last couple of years, and this is, you know, kind of the first product, you know, of that new generation. So it's possible that this will be, you know, Google's first, you know, genuinely successful attempt at making one of these fitness tracker watches. But you know, time will tell.
I like the pun. There you go. Watch and time. You were saving that one, right?
I was.
Okay. And then finally, with the presence of AI rising every day, questions are being raised about how much energy AI technology uses. So Google recently released some statistics on how much energy their AI, Gemini, uses when people are giving it prompts. So how much energy does each prompt use?
According to Google, a single prompt is roughly the same amount of energy consumption as watching your television at home for less than 9 seconds.
That's an interesting measurement. So
it is an interesting measurement. Yeah. And that measurement is quite intentional for a couple of different ways. There's a technical paper that Google released this week that breaks down the way in which we've been measuring consumption of resources for AI is kind of insufficient. We talk about how much water has been consumed and how much energy, how much like actual wattage of power is used mm-hmm. in you know, a single prompt. But there's a lot of context around that. In order for a computer that lives in a server farm somewhere to receive that instruction from Gemini, it has to be on, which means it's consuming a little bit of power just by existing. And they are on all of the time in order to be on standby for when that request comes in. And you know, the energy that goes into maintaining those machines is very much a part of how much power you know, Gemini is consuming at any given rate. And that's the same for OpenAI, that's the same for Perplexity. Like all of these systems have roughly the same system. And so what Google is trying to accomplish with this method of comparative consumption is to, you know, show that yes, power is being consumed at a constant rate, but it is materially less than a lot of your other day-to-day tasks. What Google leaves out of this is that you almost never have one prompt when
right.
it comes to a Gemini task. Yeah. You say, hey, I would like to do this, and you get the result, and you go, okay, I need to tweak that a little bit. The average Gemini task, according to Google, is not one prompt, it is seven. In order to get to the results that you're looking for. That's not, you know, across every single task, obviously, and this is different from, you know, creating an AI video or creating an AI image. This is very much what Google's talking about in this example is a text request from one to the other.
Yeah, and so basically, by comparing it to 9 seconds of TV, they're trying to make it seem not quite that bad, right? I mean, that
the idea is to make it seem like, you know, okay, well, I leave this thing plugged in my house all of the time, so this is, you know, this is using roughly that. Or I leave my TV on in you know, my house, and I don't feel particularly bad about that. Mm-hmm. You know, so that is you know, by using that comparative metric where it is, you know, equivalent to something that you're already doing in your day-to-day life, it is very much in an attempt to kind of, you know, apply context to how you consume power in your day-to-day life.
But that 9 seconds is going to add up times a billion people in the world. So, you know.
That is exactly right.
Yes. All right. We're going to leave it there. Thank you to Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce, Content, and CNET. Thank you for your time, Russell.
Thank you for having me.
This is Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. If you missed any part of today's show or any show, you can listen at our website. That's wosu.org/allsides. Subscribe to our podcast. Find all of our shows in the WOSU mobile app. And I want to thank our staff, Senior Producer Marcus Charleston, Producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, Student Producers Iza Huck and Colin Simpson. Video production is by the Ohio Channel. Board operation is from Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. And our student producer from Denison University is Kiara Burson. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.